this is going to be a bit of a ramble. You get to the end and go, well, you didn't tell us much. But I'll tell you, it's bloody hard to find out what's going on. That's probably about as far as we'll go. Can we just have the first slide? There we go. This is to get you in the mood, right? Bliss was it in that dawn to be alive, but to be young was very heaven. And those of you who are not tutored in English can answer me this question. Who said that? Wordsworth. Wordsworth. Yeah, he wrote this before his great disillusion, of course. But I just, you know, it is just that, just remember the one thing you want to remember about the 1790s, and it's so easy to lose this in today's cynical climate, is that in the 1790s, people imagined the world could be remade. They really thought that. They weren't sort of cynical about it. They thought it could be done. They sort of, you know, hadn't got into that sort of terrible kind of malaise we've got into now, where ideology is a bad thing. but, you know, per se, and there's really, you know, we just get cynical, don't we? Because we think it will go wrong. But in the 1790s, no, the world could be remade. Let's just have the second slide. Because this is the end of the same passage from Wordsworth. Where would it be made? Not in utopia, subterranean fields, or some secreted island. Heaven knows where. But in the very world, which is the world of all of us. The place where, in the end, we find our happiness, or not at all. Brilliant rationalism about that, isn't there? It's about real life, it's about real places. It isn't sort of just imagining a world that could be invented. This is about reality. For Wordsworth, well, he got disillusioned. Nevertheless, it was a fine start. So, one of the things it does is that it helps to contextualise perhaps the way that people began to feel about rights, about prospect of revolution and so on in the 1790s after the French Revolution. In England, there's a feeling that the world could be remade. It's a dangerous time, actually, in many ways. And in the initial period, straight after the French Revolution, there's a huge body of opinion in this country which appears to have been broadly in favour of events in France. It all goes a bit sort of cockeyed after the Terror and the Republic and the execution of the French King, but at least until that point, there's a very broad a consensus of public opinion that, well, the French Revolution must be quite a good thing, I mean, for a number of reasons. First of all, they used to be just a sort of bunch of, aristocrats and peasants, and if they're going to have a revolution, it's going to be a constitutional revolution, they'll create a constitutional monarchy. Before we know where they are, they'll be just like us. And they'll just be following our great example, because that's what we're like, and it's great here. And so good for the French. You know, about time they called up. It's sort of rather patronising, but a fine thing. The other thing about the French, of course, was that they were our great trading rivals. They were the great British trading rivals. And there's nothing quite like helping your own trade to prosper than have a revolution in a neighbouring state. I mean, it's a bit brilliant, you know. So any trouble that's going on over the continent must be good news for us, per se. So there's all sorts of reasons why these ideas find their constituency. But nationally, if we're going to look at the attitudes of, history from below, we're going to look at the attitudes of ordinary folk, never mind the intellectuals, never mind the kings, the queens, the parliamentarians. What are the attitudes of ordinary folk? And the one great advantage that we have when we think about this in a national context is that, fortunately, ordinary folk formed their own political organisation in London, the London Corresponding Society, in 1792. Extremely radical, extremely unusual, because for the first time, reformers from across the board, without any distinction of class, invited a broad front to campaign on behalf of universal manhood suffrage. First time any organisation had done that, and their watchword was members unlimited. We will not limit the number of people. We are going to play the numbers game, folks. We're going to start petitioning for reform, and we're going to assume it's not the principal inhabitants of the town that count when you're launching a petition anymore. It's not the quality of the signatures, it's the quantity. And we are the mass, and we are all disenfranchised, and we will look good if we all sign petitions. So there is a kind of sense that that a members unlimited is a good move in 1792. So the fortunes of the London Corresponding Society are probably, well, they are reasonably well known, and I won't go into the history of the London Corresponding Society, because what we're interested in is how that plays out in Bristol. What we know is that the London Corresponding Society set up links with provincial societies and provincial radicals right across the country. These things mushroom all over the place, where they pop up in Sheffield and Manchester and Bath and everywhere. Radical, universal suffragist, members unlimited organisations. So we think, right, Bristol, the nation's second city, it must have had a pretty active and vibrant corresponding society. You would think so, wouldn't you? And for all I know, it did. The trouble is, you're really disappointing now, aren't you? The trouble is, you know, I'm talking about the Bristol Corresponding Society, I don't know, bugger all about it. There are real problems with uncovering what's going on in Bristol. Historians have traditionally suggested that the Bristolians are just kind of out to make money. They're not interested in politics. They're all very happy here. They're very proud of living in Bristol, whatever social class they happen to come from. And so they don't, they just don't really get it together to organise a radical corresponding society. They're not revolutionaries in Bristol. That's not the way they do it here. They're not interested. Well, of course, the reason, I think, that historians have leapt onto that particular sort of trajectory is simply because there's a terrible absence of evidence to suggest anything else. And so it's easy to sort of say, well, in the absence of any evidence to the contrary, we'll assume that the Bristol working class were extremely loyal. So it's very tempting, isn't it, to try and sort of dig underneath that and find out, what was going on? What can we say then? What can we find out? Just have another slide. I've got a picture instead of a thing. This isn't Bristol, of course, this is London in 1795, and this is the London Corresponding Society addressing meetings in the open air, another great innovation of the Corresponding Society movement. Meetings in the open air, to members unlimited, rather sort of grotesquely portrayed by James Gilray here, the Steve Bell of the 1790s, as a grotesque lumpen proletariat, about whom, you know, we can draw our own conclusions. The bloke on the rostrum shaking his fist there in a rather unseemly and degrading manner is actually John Thelwall, who was an extremely polite and well-educated man, but represented here nevertheless as sort of wild tub thumper, because that's the rhetoric of the period. But so what we want to do is find things like this going on in Bristol. Wouldn't it be great? Wouldn't it? Yeah, wouldn't it? And as I say, it's difficult to find. Now, we have to ask, first of all, we'll go through in a minute what we do know about what happened in Bristol, but let's talk first about why it might be a problem to uncover the sort of fundamentalist radical activity in Bristol in the 1790s. Well, first of all, Bristolians do seem to have, they inherit a sense of shared community, collective community identity, built around pride in commercial success. There is a sense, it's fostered by people up there and dumped on people down there, but that doesn't mean people down there don't necessarily assimilate it. There's a sense in which Bristol is a place to be proud of. In 18th century England, its wealth and its success are second to only to London. And to be a Bristolian is something to be. And the civic elite in Bristol do their very best throughout the 18th century to get that sort of familial community sense of belonging adopted by people at all social levels. That is a very Bristolian thing, and you can certainly see instances where it's there. And we can talk about it as just a sort of vague rhetoric that doesn't really count. But nevertheless, there's something there which makes it a bit more difficult to set up a sort of a factional opposition. There's also a sense, and it builds onto this, I think, that Bristol is on the decline. There's a worry. There's a sort of people looking over their shoulders by the 1790s at competing ports in the north of England and in Glasgow. Glasgow, Liverpool in particular. Two big economies that are flourishing and growing, apparently at the expense of Bristol. And if you're kind of concerned about the inheritance of the city and that we've all done quite well out of it, and you know, what's going on? You know, we just seem to be losing it somewhere. We were in our zenith in the 1730s and 1740s, and now it's all downhill. So there's a sort of a sense of collective concern, perhaps even at worker level, that things are not all that rosy in the economic in the economic world, and that that's something that needs to be sorted out one way or the other. There are also shared concerns about the consequences of ending the slave trade. Of course, in an era of liberty and the rights of man, it's easy for liberals to tick on the idea of ending the slave trade. It's a jolly good idea, and of course it is a jolly good idea. But nevertheless, it's quite difficult in Bristol, of all places, to promote the end of the slave trade very vociferously, because there are large numbers of people whose work, whose labour appears to depend upon it and their economic, future economic prosperity. What if our trading rivals just sort of overtake us completely? There are concerns about this, and it just makes life more difficult for a radical platform on a libertarian, universal suffragist platform to establish itself. And all this brings about divisions amongst potential reformers. You get, I think, two particular kinds of reformer emerge in Bristol. Two particular agendas are followed. The first of them is the one which sort of blames everything on the corporation. The corporation have looked after us quite well since the 1720s, but they really did want to get their act together. And look at them. They're past their sell-by date, they're unaccountable, they're unelected. And this is an era when we start to believe in political accountability. Look at the bloody useless lot. Let's get rid of them. Let's bring in some new ones. Let's re-energise the corporation. Let's blame the corporation because they haven't improved the docks. Let's blame the corporation because the centre of the town is unpassable for traffic. The corporation is at fault. The corporation must be reformed. That's one discourse that sort of launches itself through as a radical critique. But the other, and I think Mike will probably talk a bit more about this later on, but it's that kind of liberal critique of commerce, which suddenly begins to find commerce vulgar and deeply unattractive. The thing which has made Bristol great over the last 100 years, previous 100 years at least, is now considered to be something which is sort of grubby. It's associated with grubbiness. Thomas Beddoes, who's certainly Mike will talk about, says, for example, that a sense of justice, not the spirit of commerce, is what we need to tranquillise the dissensions of mankind. And a friend of his, Robert Lovell, a poet, wrote this brilliant poem called Bristol, a Satire, which is actually a piss take of another poem published several years earlier, in which he just lambasts the magistracy and the corporation for kind of inward-looking, introspective behaviour, being a corporation concerned only with the name, the important air, the fur-clad gown, and the magisterial chair. What bloody use are they? And it's not commerce, it's not capital, it's not money, it's not revitalising the docks that matters, it's justice, a sense of justice and humanity that's required. So this sort of critique of commerce really sort of undermines everything that Bristol has built its name on. And it's pretty obvious, isn't it, that the elite in Bristol don't find it particularly difficult to get at those characters, because their main critique of those characters is that they don't come from Bristol. They're outsiders, they are. They don't really have an outside ideology. What is all this rejection of commerce and the vulgarity of petty cash? I don't think so. These people, they don't belong here. And look at them. They all come from somewhere else. It's true of Beddoes. It was true of Lovell. It was true of a great many of them. It was true of Coleridge, who again might not be telling us about later. But after the there was a terrible riot on Bristol Bridge in 1793, in which a number of people lost their lives. Coleridge was accused of being an outsider. He wanted to complain about that. What do you know about it? You're not from round these parts. And Coleridge said, well, if killing unarmed citizens is considered to be a local virtue, I glory that I'm an alien in your city. So we get that kind of great sort of to and fro between people who are aliens and proud of it, and people who are trying to coalesce the old civic identity and fight these foreigners off. But this does make it difficult, I think, for radicals to organise. Now, our main problem, if we're looking at people below the level of people like Coleridge and Beddoes and Lovell, our main problem really is that if you're a historian looking at the history of corresponding societies and radical organisations elsewhere in the country, what do? We go to the National Archives and we go to our local archives and we talk through our newspapers and we look at private correspondence and what are we looking for? Well, we look for evidence of the activities of church and king clubs. It's always the people up there who leave most of the records behind. Of course, you wouldn't expect the Bristol Corresponding Society to have kept meticulous records and then dumped them somewhere in an archive where we can all go and look at them. Unfortunately, that's just not something that happens. So we have to look at the archives of people whose only interest in the Corresponding Society was to shut them up. So it's a pejorative and prejudiced archive, and we have to find ways of cutting across it. But we can go first of all to the church and king clubs, the loyalist clubs set up in the 1790s to combat the Corresponding Societies. There's a great archive of this stuff in London. The John Reeves archive in the British Library is a fantastic repository of the owning class and their sort of efforts to contain and constrain radical protest. So obviously the boot is on the wrong foot, but nevertheless the information is there. Unfortunately, if you trawl through it looking for information about Bristol, you don't get very far, because for some reason or other there was no loyalist association, official loyalist association, set up in Bristol in the 1790s, which is a bit odd, bearing in mind Bristol is the second city. There's one just about in every other town in England, but in Bristol, no, there's not one. And the local authority, the corporation, give no support to people that are trying to set up a loyalist association in the town. So that's odd, and it's also most inconvenient. Where else might we look? Well, we look in the records of central government. What usually happens in most towns is that there's radicals running around in the streets doing anything. Local magistrates will immediately write to the Home Secretary and say, there are radicals running around the streets doing stuff. Bring some troops. We need troops. And then troops arrive and then lots of people are arrested. There are sedition trials and we can all say, oh yes, well, yeah. Historians can leap in on that stuff and say, oh no, well, now we know there's a whole load of radical activity going on because the magistrates have uncovered it. Unfortunately, Bristol's magistrates don't seem to have any interest in uncovering radicalism going on around them. There might be because there isn't any. It's not very likely in a city this size. So there's something funny going on there as well. And again, the archive is a bit silent, really. Because the magistrates are inactive and don't bother writing to the Home Secretary about what's going on, neither do they bother arresting anyone very much. So the other great place we'd like to look is in the legal record. Let's look through the archives of the local courts. Let's see who was put on trial for sedition and treason and riot. You know, but in Bristol, bloody hell, there's hardly anyone. Again, very disappointing, actually, if you're trying to find out what's going on. And you can see why historians have gone away from this, thinking to themselves, well, that's it. Bristolians are useless. They've got no interest in radical politics. They're all just out to make money, and they love the corporation. Because there's an absence of evidence to the contrary. So on the odd occasions when central government write to the mayor of Bristol and say, look, we've got this circular letter we're sending around to everyone in the country, actually, and we're asking if you can tell us what the state of radical organisation is in your city. And we've had replies from Manchester and Sheffield and Chichester and Golders Green, and I mean, we're just about everywhere, but not in the second city. So could you just sort of bend yourselves to send us a reply to our letter? And the mayor of Bristol finally replies and says, what does he say exactly? Radicalism is ineffectual in Bristol. 1793, radicalism is ineffectual. In 1794, asked about it once again, the mayor denied having any information about radical clubs in the city. I don't have any information. I can't help you. It's fine here. Leave it. So that's not very helpful to us either. It's quite interesting. You think, what's the problem here? What's going on? Well, the one thing you can say about the Bristol elite, Bristol Corporation, is that they're incredibly introspective, very inward-looking. They're very proud, of course. They've got a great noble mercantile tradition, but they've also got exclusive powers to run their own law courts. I mean, Bristol's a county from the 14th century onwards, as well as the town. So it runs its own courts, it appoints its own magistrates, it runs its own policing system, such as it is. It doesn't really think that it has to look to London for anything very much. So there's a sort of a sense in which they imagine themselves to be a bit of an island, I think, and the second city. Let's hear it for the second city. We don't need London. We're the second city. We're all right. We've got everything here. We can deal with it. But the thing is that the corporation is, by the 1790s, dominated by dissenters. And dissenters in the 1790s do like to keep their heads down a bit, because there's a kind of a tacit assumption that dissenters are more likely than most to find themselves in the radical camp. They are a bit sort of egalitarian. Methodists, Quakers, watch them. Quakers don't even like going to war. You know, they're bloody useful, aren't they? So there's a sort of sense, you know, that if you've got a dissenter, and the principal corporation are very respectable dissenters, so, you know, most of them are dissenters, and there's a sense in which I think they feel that keeping quiet is more sensible than jumping up and down and drawing attention for themselves. You see that particularly in 1791, when in Birmingham the priestly riots break out. The priestly riots attack church and king mob, attacks dissenting chapels, and Joseph Priestley, the dissenting scientist, great man of learning, and the Enlightenment, had his laboratory and house sacked by anti-radical, pro-church and king crowds. And half the city is then, you know, well, number of buildings in the city are sacked and set on fire. And because the Bristol dissenters, particularly those in the corporation, think, oh God, you know, this is bloody, we're loyal, we are, but you know, let's keep it quiet. And the next thing they start to receive anonymous threatening letters from persons unknown. The mayor gets one, various other members of the corporation get them. You know, we'll be coming down with a number of stout and hearty fellows from Birmingham, and you're next. You know, oh bloody hell. So what should we do? What should we do? Shall we ask for troops? Shall we raise a fuss? Shall we tell the Home Secretary? There's a great debate about this in the council. And in the end, they do write to the Home Secretary to suggest that there has been a problem. But they do ask the government to keep it very quiet. They don't want troops sent in. What the mayor says to the Home Secretary is, he wants the government to keep it very quiet because an idea going abroad of the apprehension of a disturbance might excite in the common people a disposition to do that which it is both our inclination and duty to prevent. It'll unravel all that. He's basically saying, I think we should keep quiet, otherwise we'll give them an idea, and their idea will be that they'll burn down our houses. So, and some councillors are saying, well, we don't want soldiers anywhere near the city, it's a very bad idea. And in the end it turns out, well, according to the mayor, who's very kind, does keep stum about it, there were one or two unpleasant incidents in the city aimed at members of the corporation, whether or not they were dissenters, but he doesn't really tell us what they were about. So they keep quiet about that. In 1793, it turns out, there are anonymous threats dumped on corporation members to burn down the city docks. The idea is, well, that somebody wants to burn down the city docks. It was linked to another campaign that was going on in Liverpool at the same time. And it's got something to do with radical politics. Very likely. By the look of the letters, it's got something to do with radical politics. But the corporation don't want to do anything about that either. So again, it's like, keep quiet about that. So it's really nothing to worry about. I think they'll just deal with it. They probably won't set fire to the docks. And so again, they do inform the Home Secretary, but they ask him not to act upon it. And you can also see this kind of quietism, this introspection, in their attitude to electioneering during the times of parliamentary elections in Bristol. Party feeling and political division in Bristol rested traditionally on the right to have an election. I mean, Bristol actually has quite a broad franchise. It's not one of them. Well, it's not a rotten borough by any means. It has a freeman franchise. And the thing about the freeman franchise in Bristol is that whenever you have an election, more and more freemen get created because you can buy a freedom. So whatever party you happen to be agitating for, it's in your interest to go round, secure votes from people on the grounds that, well, I'll buy your freedom for you, and then you can vote, and you'll vote for me, won't you? And yes, of course I will. I said that for the other vote, you know. And you can, well, it's quite easy to corruptly vote for more than one person in the 18th century, but it's quite a buoyant and lively political culture. So it's not so much the sort of the demand that there should be voting in Bristol. In Bath, only 30 people could vote. They were the members of the corporation already, and they voted for themselves, you know, basically, and a couple of nominees. But in Bristol, you know, there's quite a large constituency of voters, and it grows with every election. So what really gets people upset in Bristol is the two parties, the Whigs and the Tories, sort of going into cosy deals to avoid an election. elections are not only expensive, because you have to bribe loads of people to vote for you, but they're also potentially disorderly. So what the two parties would traditionally do in the 18th century was say, how many seats do we have in Bristol? Two. How many parties do we have? Two. What's the solution? One guy each. And this sort of comes up year in, year out. And well, there are, in the 1790s, because that's the period we must talk of, there are moments where independent candidates sort of stand forward to try and break the cosy deal. It happened a few times, actually. Certainly in 1790 it happened. A man called David Lewis is put up by something called the Society of Independent Freemen, but he withdraws before the polls come to much of a conclusion, so his intervention isn't particularly interesting. In 1796, much more interesting intervention, when the cosy deal between the Whigs and the Tories is split on the Whig side by a man who stands against the official Whig candidate, that called Lord Sheffield, who is presented by the splitter as an advocate of slavery, or an apologist for the slave trade, and an all-round sort of bad egg, really. So this man is called Benjamin Hobhouse. In 1796 he stands against the official Whig candidate, which means there must be an election, because there's at least three candidates. I mean, in the end there were more than that, but there's going to be at least three. There has to be an election, and the expected disorder occurs. But the interesting thing is the way the electoral argument went. You know, first of all, Hobhouse was an outsider. It wasn't only his ideology that was wrong, he didn't come from Bristol. So that's really pumped out by the two parties, the Tories and the Whigs, who want everything to carry on an even keel. And then they really get into his ideology. Well, his ideology, actually, Benjamin Hobhouse, is a very liberal, kind of wishy-washy liberal reformer of a sort, you know, who's quite keen on, I mean, he's sort of pro-dissent, he wants to repeal the Test and Corporation Acts. He's got some ideas about a vague extension of the franchise, but he's not a universal suffragist. And he is opposed to slavery, but that's not that radical in 1796. And so what happens to him is he's lambasted as being a Republican French atheist, which is really, really going over the top on the poor guy. But as a result, he doesn't get anywhere. And he has to withdraw. Not before a crowd forms in his favour, incidentally, and smashes the windows of the council house and the Whigs, which is one up to them, I suppose. But because of the shame of being associated with French Republican atheist politics, and being a friend of Tom Paine, and a number of other things which he probably wasn't, he withdrew from the poll and kept apologising for the next 3 or 4 years about what had happened to him. So that's not a particularly auspicious start either, is it? There are some interesting things going on nevertheless. Trade union activity is quite interesting in the 1790s. In 1792, there's an absolute strike wave launches itself across Bristol. In August, in the summer of 1792, this is what's amazing, but it's not that people went on strike. People did go on strike in the 18th century, but it's usually, you know, it's one trade go on strike and the other trades go, well, it's not our problem. We're not the working class, you know, that comes later. You're a hatter, we're a collier, bugger off. In 1792, something interesting happens. Not only does Tom Paine publish The Rights of Man, not only does the London Corresponding Society form with this idea of bringing everyone together and Members Unlimited to fight for universal manhood suffrage. Not only is that going on in the country and the rights of man being distributed like a lucky coin through every town in England. Not only that, but trade unionists start coming out in sympathy with one another. Well, that's what it looks like they're doing. Pretty extraordinary. So in Bristol, in the summer of 1792, you'll find the brick moulders, the tailors, the pipe makers, the tillers and plasterers, the shoemakers, the plumbers, the staymakers, the sailcloth makers, the bakers and the colliers, all on strike at once. I see, we talk about general strikes, do we, in the 1790s, but I mean, it wasn't declared a general strike, and there was no, as far as I can see, no organisational body trying to bring everybody out at once. But it was a summer when lots of people went on strike together. And if you're interested in that moment that Edward Thompson describes as the time when political aspirations and economic grievance suddenly find themselves in close cooperation, and that's what makes the working class, sometime in the 1790s. You know, these are the things to look for, aren't they? Trades all coming out at the same time. It's quite unusual. People carry on striking workers' strike in Bristol throughout the 1790s, actually. They're on the shipwrights in 1794, the colliers in 95, masons, tailors and shoemakers in 96, carpenters and pipe makers in 1799. 1799 is the year that the Combination Acts were passed, supposedly to prevent this sort of thing from going on, because the government can get fed up with it, really. So in 1800, the shipwrights and the tailors go on strike, regardless of the Combination Acts. So there's something to look at there. But then we also have to think about, well, what about the big crowd events? Maybe we can say there are some big crowd events in the 1790s, and the best known of them is the Bristol Bridge riots. I can see it from here. This is weird, isn't it? Anyway, just over there, the Bristol Bridge riots of 1793. There's someone doing a talk on this later on, or they've already done it. Have they already done it?
It's later in the week.
It's later in the week, so I don't want to steal their thunder, because you'll want to go and find out more about that. But it's basically a sort of it's a revolt, it's a sort of can't pay, won't pay campaign against what seemed to be an unjustified extension of the tolls on the bridge. You have to pay to come in and out of the city. If you're coming from the south or going out to the south from the centre, it's the only way across the river, otherwise you've got to go on a ferry, so it's much more convenient if you've got a cart, you want to go across the bloody bridge, don't you? And there are tolls to pay when you go through. But in 1793, it was suggested that the tolls had all been, enough tolls had been collected to pay for the expenses of building the bridge, so really it would be all, in all fairness, the tolls should now cease. That was all that had been promised. But for some reason or other, the bridge trustees decided that it was necessary, because they had some overheads, I think, necessary to keep those tolls. It was like the Sky Bridge thing, actually. Not at all dissimilar to what happened on the Sky Bridge. And just like on the Sky Bridge, people refused to pay. The upshot of all which was that people got shot by soldiers. 11 people were killed on Bristol Bridge, at least, and 45, at least, were wounded. They go into the details of all that, because that'll be in another talk, but what's really interesting is what happens when the Bristol Corporation think about what to say. I mean, the Bristol Corporation, they are the magistrates. The magistrates have to read the Riot Act to send the troops in, and the troops have shot 11 people dead, and they've wounded at least 45 others, some of whom weren't even on the bloody bridge. They were standing up on the corner of Wine Street, because once you start firing in an enclosed area like a city, musket bullet can fire, leap straight up the high street and go that far. There are people being shot who are just sort of walking by somewhere else. And it's not looking very good, and this is bad publicity. So what do the magistrates of Bristol do? Do they write to the Home Secretary and say, there's been a bit of a problem here, you might want to sort of give us some help? No, they don't do anything. They keep bloody quiet about it for several days, which is pretty extraordinary. So that in the end, the Home Secretary writes to the Mayor of Bristol to say, do you think you could tell me what's been going on the streets of Bristol? I'm forced to rely upon rumours circulating on street corners, which tell me that apparently the magistrates are going to be put on trial for murder. Is it true, and if so, why? And what happens is the magistrate then kind of thinks, well, I better sort of tell him something about it. Been a bit of a problem, actually. But it's all right now, everything's sorted. Nobody gets to the bottom of this. It's only because, in the end, a number of Bristolians got together and said, oh, I really do think this needs to be given a bit more exposure. Let's find out, let's expose what's happened on the bridge. That finally, we do get a whole body of evidence that tells us a bit more about what's going on. Can you just give us a slide? This is a great example, and can't read it from there, so don't try, it's pointless. But let me just tell you what this is. This is a pamphlet, one of many broadsides published after the 1793 riot. Inquisition for Blood Shall Be Made is its main object. This is produced about a month after the bridge riot has taken place, and it's an indication that people in Bristol, what they really want is for someone to know what's been going on the bridge. It's a call for Bristolians to stop being so supine and overawed by the magistrates, to make inquiries into the deaths, to make them known publicly, to ensure someone gets prosecuted, if anyone should be. I mean, clearly somebody should be. So it's a sort of an open riposte to the sort of quietest introspection of the magistrates. And the Bridge Riot leads, there's a right old Ferrari after it, of course, when the council corporation continually say, no, I don't think we need a public inquiry. And we need a public inquiry. It's very unfortunate and we're very sorry and we wish it hadn't happened, but it has happened and I really think we should just move on. And there's a whole bunch of people, of course, campaigning to have a proper public inquiry, the minutes of which committee still exist in the public library, and you can read them. But a full inquiry, a proper accountable inquiry, has never helped. A bit like the aftermath of the Peterloo massacre, actually, in that respect. So the Bridge Riot actually sort of brings about, there are terrible divisions in Bristol, I think. You can look at some sort of things that really do cause division, social division in Bristol, and the aftermath of the Bridge Riot is a pretty good one. At the time of the 1831 Reform Riots, you know, there are people in the crowd shouting out, let's give them Bristol Bridge, which meant chuck things at soldiers, basically. I mean, there's a memory, a radical memory that goes back to the Bristol Bridge and doesn't forgive and doesn't forget. I think that's indicative of the fact that in 1795, 2 years after this, the first full-blown food riot that Bristol ever sees occurred in the middle of town. The first full-blown food riot for 42 years. Again, people say the Bristol mob is the most fearsome mob in the country. Well, some people used to say that. I'm not quite sure on what grounds they said that, but it was sometimes said. And if it was, so when there are food riots raging right across the country, you'd expect there must be some pretty thumpingly good ones in Bristol. Actually, there are very few. 1795, there's a riot in the meat market, a riot over meat prices. I say a riot, well it is a riot actually, it's quite a violent one. And a number of windows get shattered and property gets damaged, which, as Steve Mills was suggesting to you earlier, is actually quite unusual in food riots. Food riots can be quite a lot of sedate affairs. Riot is the language of the authorities, isn't it? Not of the people. The people just regulate prices. The authorities call it riots. But there's not even much of a regulation of prices going on in Bristol from 1753 until 1795. You think, well, what's that about? Like, you can say, well, maybe these divisions have just sort of come to a head by 1795, so the old consensus has slipped and fallen apart. And the rights of man rhetoric and the trade union activity and everything else that goes with it might be a constituent factor. But what's the real reason behind the problem? Well, the thing is about the Bristol Corporation, and once again, is that the one thing they're really good at is understanding mercantile activity. You know, they understand what to do when there's a scarcity. They know how to keep their people safe. We're a port. You know. It's not difficult for merchants to get together and say, right, either we want a bloody great riot in the grain market, or we get together and we buy some food, and we buy some grain from India, America, whatever, we ship it in, and we sell it at a reasonable price to the poor. The poor will love us for this, incidentally, and will help to cement the social bonds of the city. and also because it will prevent riots, and it will ensure that the market is properly provisioned. And that, I'm being generalistic here, but you can see that happening through the big food scarcity of 1766 is a good one, 1757 is another. Throughout the rest of the country, there's a great deal of food rioting going on, but not in Bristol. So all of this doesn't sort of help us, does it, when we're trying to sort of uncover what's going on at the sort of bottom end and in the popular reform society. So, all right, what do we know about the radical clubs in Bristol in the 1790s? Well, we do know that in 1792, according to the London Corresponding Society, who lived left something behind, you know, about the people they were in touch with, there is a radical society, at any rate, in Bristol, and they are in correspondence with them. And the people in Bristol say, everything's going really well here. We've had a few problems with the mayor. One or two publicans have not been very keen on us holding public meetings, but, you know, numbers are on the rise and things are looking quite good. It's pretty wishy-washy stuff, and it's the kind of thing you would say, isn't it, unless you're trying to suggest that you're in full-blown retreat. But there's obviously, there is a society of some kind. Whether it's the same thing as the Bristol Constitutional Society that sort of builds up a little bit later or not, or whether it isn't, is rather difficult to say. But it's awkward, really. The time when it starts to get clearer is after 1795. In the latter part of the 18th century, in the latter part of the 1790s, you finally see radical clubs organising from an underground perspective. And that does start to get a bit more interesting, I suppose. there appears to have been a society of United Englishmen in Bristol, an insurrectionary society of United Englishmen. Not a great deal is known about that either, but correspondence sort of picked up by government and shifted around. Once you start thinking that there's an insurrectionary organisation in Bristol, you do something, you better keep tabs on that then. There's a man called William Bennett, who is caught distributing pamphlets outside the Exchange by the mayor. The pamphlets say, "Rise, rise, virtue, send forth thy daring instruments, confident in all is ours." Exactly what that means is slightly mysterious, I know. But nevertheless, it's a sort of thing we might want to hear. And he's arrested, and he's taken before the mayor, and he's released because the mayor doesn't really want to make any prosecutions. He's released probably with a stern warning. On his way back to the council house, on his way from the council house back to the rooms of the corresponding society, stroke constitutional society, whichever it is, he's attacked by a crowd, and the crowd chase him all the way back to the clubhouse. He locks himself in, along with the owner of the place. They're besieged for 2 days by a loyalist crowd outside. So one really good indication we have that there's popular activity on the streets of Bristol. Unfortunately, it's anti-radical activity, and the radicals are hiding inside. And every time they appeal to the mayor to come to their aid, they get bloody well nothing back. A constable turns up and says, "Well, they're all very disloyal, and I think we'll deal with them later. But everybody should go home," and then that's about as far as it gets. And it's really not particularly helpful. All right, so after 1797, 98, there's just these kind of indications that Bristol's involved with some more insurrectionary activity, but it's quite hard to get to grips with. One thing that's happening is that they're in correspondence with the United Irishmen. The United Irishmen are hoping, through their correspondence with the French, to organise little sort of uprisings in major British ports, including Bristol, at the time of the Irish Rebellion in 1798. They're hoping, but it's not very easy to organise either. There are just little sort of there are indications that there are things in Bristol. Bennett is finally arrested in London at the United Irish, United Britons, and London Corresponding Society for a joint meeting with plans for pikes in his pocket. Pikes are to be shipped to Bristol, it is said. A man called Robert Watson is to go with him. Robert Watson was a known adventurer and revolutionary. But we know they all came here, we just don't know quite what they did when they got here. And because the arrests of the arrest of Bennett took place at a particular time in London, I think before anything else could be done, you just don't really find out what was happening. The nearest thing we get to something exciting happening is actually 1799, when two United Irishmen are tracked down by the Bristol authorities at their lodgings in Queen Square. They're on the run from the 1798 rebellion by this stage. And the mayor turns up with a force of soldiers, arrests them, takes them off for questioning, sends them to London. So that is honestly about as far as it gets. Alright, so there are difficulties in trying to uncover sort of plebeian radicalism in Bristol in the 1790s, and I've just been trying to suggest to you why some of those difficulties might arise. But I'll stop now and let Mike carry on. Mike will talk to us about people about whom we do know rather more, I think.